you guys ever go through this many like loop-de-loos when you're trying to record either one of your shows? Because there's three of you guys to coordinate.
I know. Well, we do have some technical difficulties sometimes. Sometimes we can't even get on the show. So it's a lot of things that have to do with Blog Talk Radio, because it's a much larger situation that we have to work with under their umbrella.
Okay.
But generally, they're decent. There have been a couple times they just cut us off mid-sentence, and we don't ever realize that we've been cut off until somebody tells us, like, oh yeah, I was listening to your show until it got cut off. But we're still talking, so we thought that it was still on air. But
awesome.
Yeah.
Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada. You are listening to episode 126 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. I am really excited about today's episode for several reasons. Even though we're not going to discuss the film that we thought we were going to discuss, it is the final episode in what I believe was a wonderful year film. It will have us discussing a film that's really striking a chord for so many, and it brings on a guest whose writing and podcasting chops I've admired for a long, long time, because she cranks out content at an obscene rate with a keen eye for pointing readers and listeners towards films they might otherwise have missed. We are across a wire to New York City this afternoon. What part of New York City?
Brooklyn.
Very nice. Talking to the brains behind Real Talk Online, a site you can find at realtalkonline.org. She's also the co-host of Cinema et Noir and Black Girl Nerds. Candace Fredericks is here today. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm super, super stoked. I must apologize. Anytime I've like typed your name to like link it or something, or even right there when I was talking in the intro, I always have the desire to add an S onto your last name. I don't know why.
Everybody does.
God damn.
I said I'm singular. I'm not plural.
That's awesome.
I say that all the time.
And that's how I'm going to remember now. She is singular. Two quick notes before we get into the show. You might have noticed on episode 125, or you might not have. Once upon a time, I used to have chapter breaks possible in the podcast. You could like skip through certain sections. They are no longer, mostly just because the people who make the software I make my podcast with are a bunch of dumbasses and decided not to give me that. So I have bumped the show notes up. So if you look at your little gizmo, you should be able to tap the info button and see the time stops, and you can kind of jog ahead. Apologies if that ever sorts itself out, or if anybody's got any great ideas on how I can do that. I'm all ears, but for now, no chapter breaks. Second, Miss Frederick, singular, is in demand. So this will be a shorter episode than usual. We are going to truncate the other side, and we're going to leave aside feedback for this episode. Everything's going to get back to normal in January, but I wanted to seize the moment, so we're working with what we got. But on episode 126, we will be discussing Selma. We will be turning the record over to play the other side for a little while, but before that, we need to learn more about Candace, and this is Know Your Enemy. Inquiring minds want to know, what is the first film you can remember seeing in a theater?
I'm sure there have been previous movies, but the one, just because this one had a specific experience that's way more hilarious than it should be, is Malcolm X, actually. I'm going to backtrack.
Okay.
Actually, it was Little Mermaid. I know that for a fact. And I got the VHS.
Yes. Okay, so a few questions here. First of all, because I know this, you did not grow up in New York, because nobody who lives in New York is from New York.
I know a lot of us are migrating,
which is cool, which is very, very cool. So yes. Where did you grow up? Where was this Malcolm X and Little Mermaid experience?
I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts, Boston proper.
Oh man, you like turned traitor on them.
I know. Every time I say that, they're like, they're ready to like fight me. I'm just like, no.
Do they let you back?
Yeah, they do, but you know, with a snarl, like okay. They're looking at me like I just like sold their child at the river.
And what do you remember about going to the Little Mermaid?
Yeah, I remember being really happy, and I also remember being singing along to the songs. Like that was a really big experience with me, and I just remember like, oh, you know, I'm going to the movies, like that, and that's like anything that was kind of like out of the house,
okay,
away from my mom was like an experience. I'm just like, cool, like I can get to be kind of like a grown-up, but I really wasn't that old. Yeah. At all. I was probably like I don't even know, maybe 7 or 8. Okay. But I thought it was cool because I was out of the house.
Now, wait, how did you know the songs already? Were you driving your parents nuts and listening to the soundtrack before you'd even seen the movie?
Yes, yes. Wow. I had the, was it the cassette I
probably
had?
It would have been, yeah, yeah. That's you're around my age, and that's before CD.
Yes,
or God knows, sure. God knows MP3.
Yes.
Now, so if you were around 7 or so when you saw Little Mermaid, you must have only been about 9 by the time Malcolm X came around.
Yeah, and you know, it's really strange a little bit. I went with my aunt and my 2 cousins, so her 2 children. And so apparently the way the story goes is that my aunt kind of just took us there, but didn't tell my mom that she was taking me there. And that movie was kind of, I guess it's for adults, even though I don't remember it being very like suggestive, but I guess there are some adult, there are some adult sequences in there. And so my mom, who was super like concerned, she was very like, she tried to really, really shelter me.
Okay.
And so she heard that I was at the movies watching Malcolm X with my cousins and my aunt. She got the security guard at the theater to yank me out, because almost like my aunt was kidnapping me, even though that clearly was not the case, but she just wanted to like basically create a scene, create a ruckus, and drag me out of the theater as if I was doing something wrong. And so that was my experience. So I actually watched only half of Malcolm X in the theater. Okay. And then I watched the rest of it at home.
Wow, that might be the best story I've heard in 126 episodes.
It was ridiculous.
I've never heard of somebody actually getting dragged out of a theater by their parents.
Yep, that was my mom.
Amazing. Like, because here's the funny thing. Like, when you first said, we're going to talk about Malcolm X later, spoiler alert for this show. But, you know, I actually just finished watching it before we went on air today. And as I'm thinking back on it, it's not tremendously inappropriate. There's a little bit of stuff. There's obviously some terrible language throughout. But it's not something I would really, really say is inappropriate for kids. But then again, you got to know your kids. So, yeah, if your mom was kind of trying to keep 2 hands on the wheel there, what's the word I'm looking for? Subverted in that manner. I'm almost more curious about the story of what happened after, but like we said,
it was a lecture. It was a lecture between me and my mom. It was also a lecture between my mom and my aunt.
Yeah. That's the part I would love to hear. What's besides the movies we're going to be talking about today, what's one of the last films you watched?
Oddly enough, I'm actually midway through The Immigrant right now. So I'm watching that now. The last full movie I saw was Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay, now time out. Are we keeping this show short so that you can finish The Immigrant? Because that's not cool.
Well, it's pausing, so it's cool. It's waiting for me.
Okay. See? No. I mean, it's not cool that I'm cutting the show short so you can watch a movie.
Oh, No.
Not, the movie can wait really. For my show. Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, I'm really excited to get back to that. It's kind of funny because I never would have guessed that would have been as big a movie this year as it was. I mean, it looked fun, and Lord knows it was cool to go to and everything. But I just thought it was kind of going to be one of those little mid-level Marvel movies, right? Like, I thought it was kind of going to perform the same as the first Thor or the first Captain America. I'm happily surprised, but really surprised that it turned into this like monster hit that it did.
I'm still surprised by that. I mean, I'm such a fan of just movies that actually have soundtracks, and I feel like it's a lot more focused on instrumental scores right now. And I would say with the last like 10 years, it's just been an influx of strictly instrumental scores. But Guardians of the Galaxy, even though none of the music obviously was original, but I just love that they were able to use these characters and kind of infuse this very retro sound, very retro music into it that I dig really hard. But yeah, I was surprised by how much conversation is still surrounding Guardians of the Galaxy. And that was months ago it came out, and people were still like, oh my gosh, it's like the best thing since sliced bread. Chris Pratt. He got like this huge, huge celebrity status bump after that. So
yeah, it's funny because my wife was watching an old episode of Parks and Rec the other day, and I walked through the room and I was like, "Damn, Star-Lord looks like he's been hitting the donuts."
Exactly. Yeah, he's had a bit of a transformation.
Absolutely. What is one of the worst movies you've ever seen?
Man, I, you know, being in the position that I am in, I watch a lot of really good movies and a lot of really bad movies. I don't discriminate, unfortunately. I can't really select. But just off the top of my head, and this is super recent, Jimmy All Is By My Side.
Okay, what is this opus?
Jimmy All Is By My Side is about the late, great Jimi Hendrix. Played by Andre 3000, now
right.
So it was. I was humiliated for everybody involved. I was like, "This is the biggest trash ever."
Oh man!
Yeah, and I was like, you know, a huge fan of Jimi Hendrix, so it's just like, this is not the way to the promised land. This is crazy.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. That's the one that they did without the approval and cooperation of Jimmy's estate, right?
Yes, and that shows.
Which, you know, danger Will Robinson, for starters. And isn't that, the director is somebody famous. Isn't the director the same dude who wrote 12 Years a Slave, or am I completely crossing myself up?
Oh, you're right. John Ridley directed and wrote it.
Okay. No, I, that is, oh, a man. Damn, you know, yeah, that was one. Like, when they talked about how Andre was going to play Jimmy, I was really, really stoked. I'm like, you know, as an actor, as a musician, this sounds like a match made in heaven. Absolutely. But the second I found out that they were doing it without the Hendrix estate permission, I thought, okay, this is either going to be really spectacular, but I don't know how in the world they can do that, because there's no way. It's not like a writer, you know, they can't, you can't have a story about a musician and not at all, especially a musician as seminal as Jimi Hendrix, and not deal with their music.
Yeah, you know, it was a really big part of his identity, and also his personal stories and his personal reflections are very evident in this song. So it's really like taking a part of that character away and really stripping it down to really basic. I actually was not a fan of the casting at all. I was just saying, I really hate this whole trend that, oh, if you're a singer, then obviously you can act. And I just don't think that works that way. And I really think he's a fantastic musician. I'm a Outkast fan forever.
Yeah.
But like Andre 3000 as an actor, like I can do without.
Like, I guess everything I've seen him in, he's always been acting a little, he's never been acting straight, now that I think about it. Because, like, when I think about stuff like, you know, he's in Be Cool, and of course he's in Idlewild, but he's never really doing drama when I've seen him do stuff. So maybe that's where I'm handcuffed, because I'm thinking of him that way. Okay, so thank you for steering me away from that 2 hours,
because
I would have been checking it out. What is a classic or essential movie that you have not yet seen?
A lot. I'm trying to think of. I mean, it is interesting because I write about, I've written posts about just not really even wanting to see many of them. Let me think. Singing in the Rain.
Really?
Is up there. I've never seen Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
I'm going back and watching some of the older movies that I just, for whatever reason, just missed. But that one is one I intentionally missed. But there's that. I've never seen Sunset Boulevard. Oh. I've never seen, let's see, Seven Samurai.
Wow.
So, yeah.
Okay, so it's kind of funny because you mentioned a good pairing early, because you've got, and actually it could make for some good fodder for a post or a podcast or something, because both Sunset Boulevard and Singing in the Rain, especially the latter, are movies about the movies. So if you ever like that kind of nesting doll type of story where you have the story within the story, it's really cool just for that particular angle. Sunset Boulevard, I become a gigantic disciple of Billy Wilder, and that's got some killer writing on it. It's also really messed up, surprisingly, for a movie from 1950 something. And Singing in the Rain, I would like both of those. I'm not gonna like chide you for not having seen them. I've said before, I envy the people who haven't seen these movies and get to watch them for the first time. You know, you don't get your first time back. I would leave you with that, is if you do feel compelled to watch them, watch those two close together, because there's some really cool things about movie history in both of them.
Oh, definitely. I actually did not know that, so that's good to know.
Definitely. And last but not least, for any rhyme or reason, what is a film that you wish you'd had a hand in making?
You know, someone else has asked me this, and I give the same answer. Like, it is funny because sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, I think on a different day I'll give a different answer, but I really had to think about this, and I really think it's the same answer, which is Closer, by the late, great answer. Mike Nichols, okay. Yes. And it's, I mean, there are many movies that I love, but this movie just seems like it would have came from me. And that's what, it's very... its ideals and my ideals are very almost identical when it comes to romance and when it comes to, you know, love and just the whole journey of romance. This, I'm a little more cynical, honest, or whatever type of word you want to describe what, or very stripped down to the point where, okay, this is like the basic nuts and bolts of two people in a relationship or two people in love or two people who are trying to chase each other, like, but they're both moving targets.
You think that we're all lying, and really it comes down to who's lying the least.
I think that's where, yes, I think that's a very basic way of saying it, but that pretty much summarizes it. Yeah. I mean, you can say the same thing about Gone Girl, which I just loved that movie. I love the book, so I already kind of went in as a disciple and was just blown away.
I've been meaning to get back to Closer. I actually, I happened to read the play this fall. It was the first time I'd actually read the script of the play and was kind of surprised at how faithful the movie adapts. And it's I own it. I should, you know, see me saying I should go back to it. It's on my damn shelf. But I haven't watched it in so long. And when we lost Mike Nichols earlier on this year, it was one of those films that I was thinking about just because of how it draws you in, but doesn't really give you somebody to latch on to except for maybe Jane. And it's because she's the one who's doing, as I said, who's doing the least amount of lying. And anytime you get a film with, you know, four dislikable people and wants you to spend time with them, that always fascinates me.
It's true. That, I mean, it's one of those really great movies, and I love this about any movie that does this. When you watch it like over and over, and I've seen it several times, I own it as well. I watch it and I pick up on new things and I'm just like, wow, I did not catch that before. And even like, you know, if I'm watching it today as opposed to several years ago when it came out, I'm like, I'm getting a new perspective. And I think it's one of those movies that really latches on to a certain time period in your life, and you really adjust to it in sense.
Totally. Yeah. And just one last question. Would you, like, you want to be the one to direct it, to write it? What part of it do you gravitate towards the most?
Writing.
Cool. Very cool. There we go. That's Candace in a nutshell. We will learn more about her when I get her back much faster than 126 episodes. So there's that. But we are going to move right along. As I said earlier, we are going to skip past feedback. You all wrote me with things that you want for Christmas, and I hope you get them all. But as I said, I ain't buying them for you. We're going to go right to the new slang. The new slang is Selma. And kind of a note just before we get into it, I'm not really going to say spoiler warnings because we're talking about a period in history that is very, very documented. So there's not really anything to spoil. That said, I do appreciate that the film doesn't come out in most major markets for 2 weeks and other markets even longer. So if you want to skip past this and just go straight to the next episode, that's cool. Thanks for stopping by. But please do stick around because this is a fantastic movie and both Candace and I will have a lot to say about it. Come on back after this for our discussion of Selma.
That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground. The camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up. One day.
Selma is directed by Ava DuVernay. It stars David Oyelowo, Carmen Ayogo, Oprah Winfrey, Tim Wilkinson, Tim Roth, Lorraine Toussaint, Common, and Giovanni Ribisi. It's the story of the 1965 Selma to Montgomery, Alabama voting rights marches led by Martin Luther King and the role they played in the civil rights movement in America. Ordinarily, discussion of a film on this podcast begins with a question that occurs to me in the run-up to the show. Today, though, the question comes from my brother, Shane. So we were talking about this film and its year-end award chances and how those chances are affected by what's going on in the world today. However, the hitch is that events pass and events get forgotten. perhaps leaving the film to twist in the wind. So, Candace, pop quiz hotshot, what role does timing play in the quality of a movie?
I think if a movie is good, it's timeless.
Okay.
Period. I do think that this, and even, you know, I was thinking specifically even of Fruitvale Station, movies that came out very indicative to what was going on at that moment. And actually, they're almost intertwined. You know, they can almost be intertwined, those stories. But I think that, you know, a great movie is timeless. But I do think that since we're already in discussion about some of its themes, it will give it a little bit more of an edge than I think it would have ordinarily received.
Here's, I have obviously had more time to think about this because I wrote the question and I already had this conversation. And I think back to last autumn when I was at the Toronto National Film Festival and Steve McQueen brought 12 Years a Slave, and somebody, it might have been the moderator, asked him, why now? This is, you know, this is an old story. This is a story that people, in some respects, that people know. So why now? And what he said was that it felt like the right time. It felt like the time to have this conversation again, and that was before they knew that they were going to be able to drop it in 2013, and that 2013 would be the 50th anniversary of the I Have a Dream speech, and unfortunately that 2013 would bring up conversations, hard conversations, surrounding the events of Trayvon Martin. Now, that was last year. Now we go to this year, and we go to a film that, it's not like this thing was put into the pike in light of certain events. This story has been knocking around Hollywood for a long time.
Yeah.
And while I don't think that what's happening in the world today gives the film any kind of a boost in terms of quality, it gives it a little bit more resonance at the moment. And strangely enough, unfortunately, when things go wrong again in the future, because they will, this film will become a touchstone again. So to answer my own question, I don't think timing plays a huge role in its quality. I think it plays a huge role in terms of its relevance. And we have what is a 50-year-old story in terms of Selma feeling very, very goddamn relevant.
Mm-hmm. Strangely enough.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say you liked this movie.
I liked it. I hesitated a bit because it's, you know, and you talked about, you know, there's no story or sub-story or premise in this movie that we could possibly spoil if you've ever been on a Wikipedia page, even that. I'm always wrestling with the freshness of stories. I went into this thinking that only really kind of focusing on the performances because I knew the story. I knew a lot of things I knew before they were even going to happen. And so, you know, the sequence of events and everything. I mean, there's one instance earlier on in the movie where I was just like, whoa, I know that happened in real life, but I wasn't expecting it at that moment.
Within the scope of this film, right?
Yes. And so when it happened, I was like, oh, but there was never any other point in the movie that gave me that, oh my goodness, I forgot that this is what we're facing. It was very, very play by numbers for me. So, but I kind of knew that going in. But one, it's beautifully shot, gorgeously shot. I just love Bradford Young to pieces. And I think that this movie kind of suffers also on the fact that there's so much great talent in it. So much great talent. I mean, I love so many of these actors from previous projects. So going in, I was just like, oh my gosh, how is Ava going to do all this? It's like a massive amount of talent.
Yeah.
And I only really think that there's only one standout performance. And to me, that's David Oyelowo. And I'm just like, that's kind of crazy to me. One, because she's dealing with so many iconic representatives of this period, but yet he is the only one who has this voice. And I think he was just exquisite, I mean, especially since he's not even American.
Yeah.
and I'm just like so surprised that he, like, whenever he hides his accent, it's just like, it's just crazy. I've had the chance to interview him twice and I'm just like, dude, how are you this dude and how are you that dude? It's just so, it's so crazy. But yeah, I think he really, I've been talking about David Oyelowo for years, and I'm glad that we all are now.
Yeah. Oh, like this is the good thing that's going to come. Well, there's going to be a lot of good things to come from this movie, but one of the best things is this is likely a, I don't want to say a star-making turn for him, but this is probably a career-making turn for him. And he's already got like such a track record behind him, but I really think that this is going to be one of those parts that lets him take that next step. I hear what you're saying, because the cast in this movie just goes and goes and goes. And like, I, you know, you heard me rhyming off a whole bunch of names off the beginning, and that's not even scratching the surface of everybody else who's in this movie. Like, scene after scene plays out, and I'm like, oh shit, he's in this? Oh,
exactly. She's in this?
And it, like it was kind of funny, because right after this movie, I went and watched Top 5, and it's like, what? It's same sort of thing where, like, people and people and people show up. It's two movies that just have, like, insane casts, and yeah, you wonder, how did one director juggle all of this? And certainly, how did one director just not get whispers in her ear? Apparently, according to Ava DuVernay, that's actually a really big the reason why she was able to kind of keep control over everybody and keep control over the whole ship was a lot of Oprah in her corner, because she says when Oprah says yes or no, that's the end of the conversation. So anytime she wanted something, she would just defer to Oprah.
that makes sense.
Yeah. I loved the holy hell out of this movie. You know, like you, I knew a lot of what was going to happen. I didn't know every last thing, I'm remiss to say. But it was still so very affecting. And it's something that's come up time and time again for me this year, of how affecting can a film be if you know the ending, whether it's a remake or an adaptation, you know, or something that's based on history. If you know how it's all going to shake down, if the film still affects you, that's a sign of quality filmmaking.
I think my one of the things that I really wanted this movie to do that I don't think it really did is really provide the human aspect. I mean, as I said earlier, there's so many icons in this movie, including Diane Nash, and now I'm like blanking on several other names, but pretty much everybody in that camp, that whole, you know, MLK camp, are very, very profound people in their various sectors within that community. They've all got other stories.
Oh yeah.
So it was just interesting to me that this one really just honed in on his life, and one of the great things, one of the great lines in the movie, later in the movie, is how he's, and I'm paraphrasing now, I'm forgetting what the name is, forgetting what the line is, but it's basically saying, I am merely a man.
Right.
Something to that extent. And I think I wanted more of that. Not even just from him, but from other characters. I felt like there were so many enriching stories to get from each of these characters. And I will say there was one other character, an older man whose name escapes me right now, but he had this tremendous scene with David Oyelowo in a morgue. I'll just say that.
Right.
And it's really, really, really great scene, and him just really, you know, sharing this monologue, and I'm like, oh my gosh, who is this guy? Yeah. He's fantastic. And so, and he's an older man. I think even in real life, well into his 70s. But I just really kind of wanted more human stories, but it seemed a little more of an umbrella story. It was almost a story of its time rather than a story of the people.
Well, okay, so here's where we disagree, actually. And you've kind of touched on some of the things I was going to bring up. So this is good. We're disagreeing, but we're of one mind. This is wonderful. You know what it is? You know what it is? You know why we're of one mind?
Why?
We have the same birthday.
What?
June 1st, man.
No way.
Seriously, I wish you a happy birthday every damn year, and you couldn't remember that?
Wait, that's true. Oh, my goodness.
Thanks. It's nice to be loved.
Oh my gosh. Yes, we do. Happy early birthday.
Yeah, What was I saying about one mind? Anyway, those human moments that you wanted, those little moments, I do feel like they're there, but I feel like they're almost so subdued that they don't, they sometimes might get mixed in the shuffle. So there's two that come through for me. And actually they came through during a Q&A of the movie this week, but it was my question, so I'm stealing it. One of them was the scene that you already mentioned where Sullivan Jackson and Martin Luther King are speaking over the body of his dead son. And here's a man, like, you know, we're so used to King being a leader and being a speaker and being in front of so many people and just being the front of a movement. And here he is listening and mourning and asking this man, what is your story? Who are you? What did you want? How did this happen? Right. Yeah. And he has very, very few lines in that scene, and he's got to let, like you said, the actor who's playing Jackson, the guy who's playing Sullivan Jackson, it's his moment to shine. But it's, we watch Oluyelowo react. We watch him wear it all on his face. And I felt like that says so much, that this is not a leader who's in this for his own gains. This is a person who's really, really in it for every last person in his movement.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, that was one. And the other one that came up in the same Q&A is a scene when Dr. King and Coretta Scott King are having an argument over his infidelity. Now, first of all, props to this movie for even touching on that.
I know, that was tricky.
Well, because, like, you know, here's a man who in the world, and specifically in your country, is pretty much sainted.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was a man, he was a human, he screwed up from time to time. But when you're canonizing him in a piece of fiction, you would think that stuff like that would just be skirted over, because it usually is. So, one, props for even including that. But we get a moment where he and Coretta Scott King are going over what he's done, and without being extremely overt about it. Like, if you want to get a good idea of the makeup of their relationship, watch this scene. And she asks him some really, really pointed questions, and he just responds. He's got one word in response, and it's no, right? And it's not said in anger. It's not said in defiance. It's one of these things where, again, he's forced, a person who usually leads, who usually is in front of a big microphone, has to listen and has to really, really think, and just gives it all in that no. And there's a lot of moments like that in this movie. I think it's maybe just a sign that they're done with such grace that we don't really latch onto them. Like, I feel like in a lesser movie, they'd be played up bigger. And because they're so subtle in here, we almost lose them.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Or am I out of my mind?
Yes. No, that makes sense. But I do feel like almost exclusively those moments are from David Oyelowo's character, obviously Martin Luther King Jr. And I just feel like,
even when he's an audience within it.
Yeah, I mean, with the exception of that one scene I mentioned of Sullivan Jackson in the morgue, I think, because that scene to me is all Sullivan Jackson.
Yeah.
I was so invested with what he was saying. That was an incredibly moving scene to me, because it was, one, I was just floored that he was even taking the time out to, you know, I'm sure that wasn't an isolated case at all.
No.
What happened there. But he took the time out to go to this one gentleman about this one instance out of many and listen to his story. And that was a very profound moment in the movie. And that was something I actually was not fully aware of going in. That wasn't a story that I really was familiar with. And so I'm always interested in these smaller stories.
Okay.
You know, what's his story? What about Diane Nash? What about, you know, I wanted to know more about Oprah Winfrey's character, or all these other people. And I feel like, and I think part of the thing is they're played by such gigantic names.
Mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
You know, you've got Common there, you've got Coleman. Oh gosh, I'm blanking on his name, but the gentleman that was closest to
Coleman Domingo.
Yes. You've got him, you've got all these people, and I'm like, I want to know what's up with him? Why is he doing this? Why now? Like, all this stuff. I get very invested, especially since I'm familiar with these faces, and I know them. You know, I know of their work, and I know what they can do. And I just feel like, and especially, I will go on the record and say, I was very disappointed with how small they made Diane Nash's story, and especially in the hands of Tessa Thompson, who I just adore.
Okay.
And I really was hoping that they would do something there. But she, I was thinking as I left the theater, like, I can only recall a couple of lines that she had even said.
Right. See, now that leads me actually to one of my next questions, because I just came away from talking about, or I just came away from watching Malcolm X, which, if you want a flip side to this movie, if you want a complete antithesis to Selma, it's Malcolm X, because it is 3 hours and encompasses pretty much everything. And I don't even think they got all of it in, but it spans a lot. Like, he's Malcolm Little for the first hour of a 3 hour movie. So that's my kind of my next question is, do you think some of these disappointments and some of these reservations are because the film decided to stay really, really focused on this one man in these few weeks? Because this movie was originally going to be a Lee Daniels film, and it was going to be radically different. It was like, this has had several rewrites, but Lee Daniels, of course, last year gave us The Butler, and that movie also felt like an antithesis to this, where it was just kind of skipping along through history. And I don't know about you. I think I do know about you, because you've kind of made it pretty clear. But I think actually the film succeeds because it stays so on point. There are so many stories. And I mean, shit, this is a Martin Luther King movie that does not have him say, "I have a dream." We see so many biopics from year to year, and some of them work, a lot of them don't. And for me, I kind of wonder if one of the things that makes it work is because it stays so much in this moment of these handful of people, admittedly with the flaw that it's almost always coming back to King.
I think that it works on that level. I do like that. It's, what is it, running under two, no, a little over 2 hours, I believe
it's
it
like
is.
202 or something.
Yeah.
But it's succinct.
But it's finite. And it's, it is. And I do appreciate that about the movie. I will say, I did really like The Butler, but yes, it wasn't a perfect movie at all. I just really like, because I've never heard that story before.
Yeah.
So I'm always interested to hear stories I've never seen before. And so in terms of Malcolm X, I think that was expansive, extremely expansive, covered a lot of different people, a lot of different characters. It wasn't just about the title character, but of course that was the main focus. But everybody seemed like, I feel like I knew their struggles, I knew their triumphs, like I knew what they hated, what they liked. Like, I felt like I knew those characters and Malcolm X.
Okay.
But I didn't really get that with Selma. And, you know, I do think that a movie, well, especially one that's 3 hours, can cover a lot but still seem somewhat intimate. And I think Malcolm X does. I mean, I just love the hell out of Malcolm X. I love that movie. I think that's still, to this day, Spike Lee's best movie. Well, one of Spike Lee's best movies, but definitely his best drama, I'll say that.
Okay.
So I just think that it is possible to have an expansive movie that covers a lot of different areas, but still seems very intimate for each character.
Yeah, it's crazy because, you know, the other thing I'm thinking is maybe this will prompt more of these stories. Like, maybe we'll get a story. I imagine the answer is probably no, or probably not for a long time, but maybe we'll get a story that focuses in on Diane Nash or Hosea Williams or Annie Lee Cooper or any of these people who I'm sure have fascinating stories. But that's the thing, maybe by having them intersect, we can build things out a little bit. I don't know, and as I said, I fear I know the answer, but it's a hope that by keeping this contained just to this, you leave the possibility of another Martin Luther King movie down the road.
Yeah, but I do think there we're in a trend where a lot of movies are kind of like this Trojan horse. I hear that phrase a lot. The Trojan horse storytelling,
and
to this day. Yeah, and I do think that to a certain degree, for me, I still think that 12 Years a Slave has a huge Trojan horse storytelling. I'm so drawn to everyone else but the main character in that. It's very strange. It's like, I want to hear more about all of the other stories. And of course, his was just so compelling, but after, you know, realizing what his story was, but going beyond that and being introduced to all these other characters, I'm like, oh my gosh, I who are you? Like, you seem very interesting. And I think that, what's her name?
Alfre Woodard?
Alfre Woodard.
Oh, she's fascinating in that movie.
Yes, I wanted to know everything about her character. I'm like, how did you get to this mindset?
Oh my
Please,
God, yes.
Tell me.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of crazy because, yeah, for a movie that's really about Solomon Northrup, the three lead female roles in that movie are the three women that I'm like, screw that guy. He's screwed. I want to learn more about these people. Oh, man.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to the other side before we run out of time. So I'm actually just going to roll it into the main section here. And we each picked another movie to go on. Now, for me, I went back a few years and watched DuVernay's first film, I Will Follow, or her first fictional feature film, I Will Follow. And for me, this was kind of a parting gift from Roger Ebert, because I am remiss to say that I hadn't heard about this movie until January. And I apologize, because I bet you $10 you've probably talked about it a dozen times and it just sailed past me.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Every time somebody says they don't listen to me, I'm just going to say, well, I don't listen to Candace. So, but it's, I watched that this week, and like the one thing I love about coming away from a movie like Selma is finding a director and just starting to go through all of their work. And pointing myself back to I Will Follow was a really, really great next step. She's got a real knack for, as I was saying, those like intimate moments. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of them in I Will Follow. It's like certainly more so than in Selma, just because it lends itself far more to them. But just, you know, all these intimate moments that can come when you're dealing with the fallout of grief, because it's about a woman who loses her aunt, and she's not really busted up in a really, really tragic way, but she's more just numb. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everybody who comes and goes in this, I think it's just like a day afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah, it's just a day. Yeah. An afternoon, I think.
Yeah. Everybody who just comes and goes from her house in this day just kind of unlocks a different part of her, like right down to the woman who's installing her cable. And I really loved going on to that intimate film after seeing, first of all, I got to hear, Ava speak after the presentation of Selma. So talk about an embarrassment of riches on a Wednesday night.
Yeah.
yeah. So, you know, digging into her filmography, and I'm going to go watch the Venus doc later. This is the kind of thing that I love about movies, is how, when you find out about talent that you didn't otherwise know about. You've seen I Will Follow. Like, what would you, what's your pitch for somebody, besides the fact of it's directed by the woman who did Selma? Why would somebody go digging for this movie just to watch for the hell of it? Like, what do you love about it?
Well, this is interesting, because I really did not like I Will Follow.
No. Wow. Okay. Why not then?
You know, and I really, really, really appreciate that it's an intimate story. And I also appreciate, I have to say, that it's a story that is not about civil war. It's not about us being, when I say us, I mean the Black community or Black characters being particularly quote unquote victims of their time. This is a really personal story about somebody is dealing with something that is indicative to their life, not the life of an entire race.
Yeah.
And I do feel like we're especially the bigger Hollywood movies right now are really focused on this moment of, you know, civil war and, civil war typeset films or stories and, you know, civil rights era. When I say, I meant to say civil rights, not civil war.
Gotcha. Okay.
But so civil rights era and, you know, like the slavery era. And I just feel like we're very, very much focused on this. And I feel, and I like that a lot of smaller films like I Will Follow are continuing to show characters of color who are just being humans in a very universal story, even though I do think that films like Selma and 12 Years a Slave, especially if you are American, that is an American story.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other discussion. But particularly I Will Follow, I could not connect with this story, even though it's personal.
Okay.
It's. I think I just love Sally Richardson Whitfield. So I'm glad that, you know, that we were finally talking about her again. But... you know, I feel like there's so much there's so much like raw emotion in that movie, and yet I did not feel any of it. Like I get that the character, or maybe because like you said, she was a little numb, a little stoic to me, and I was just like, how do you feel about this?
Well,
this
is what the thing about that though is we all grieve so damn differently, right? Like, have you ever had it? And I mean, I'm guilty of this too. Have you ever had it where somebody is affected by grief, and after a little while, you look at them and you're like, okay, come on. Or you wonder, hey, what's going on? Like, you question their grief. I think that, like, we're all guilty of that.
Yeah.
So maybe that's it.
Yeah, that is true.
But you appreciate the movie, at least. It's not like you're saying it's a bad movie.
Not really. But I do appreciate the movie in the sense, you know, in what I described about its human aspect and it being kind of a universal story that I think, you know, a lot of different people can relate to. I just think that, I think the premise is there. The premise promises something that the story does not deliver.
Okay.
And so that's just unfortunate for me. I'm just like, okay, this, I just could not connect with it. I mean, I had the same experience with Wild, but yeah.
Okay. Now, going on to your choice, though, because Lordy, your choice is very different from mine. So you mentioned, like you said to me, how long has it been since you watched Malcolm X? And my short answer was long time. But I went back and I just rewatched it this afternoon. Took up my whole afternoon.
I can see that happening. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I always recommend this movie for just people who are either unfamiliar with Spike Lee's work or unfamiliar with Malcolm X or whatever it is. I just think it does such a great job as representing Spike Lee as a filmmaker, Denzel Washington as an actor, Malcolm X as an institution, really. I mean, Malcolm X was a movement in himself. You know, there were so many other facets to his story. And that was a massive undertaking for Spike Lee. And to me, he just nailed it.
Yeah, well, and that was the one where, again, he almost wasn't able to make it because he was losing funding. Like, he reached out to every prominent African-American celebrity and like basically passed the hat around. Like, Michael Jordan gave him money. Oprah Winfrey gave him money. Magic Johnson gave him money. It's the fact that it was even able, 3-hour movie, 3-hour biopic. The fact that it was able to see the light of day by what was he at the time? Like 29?
Yeah, he's director? Super young.
My God, it's a stunning piece of filmmaking. My preference for Spike Lee kind of leans a little bit more towards Do the Right Thing.
A lot of people say that.
Well, it's, you know, it's the easy go-to, right? It's mm-hmm. got him in it the most. God knows, this summer it all of a sudden seemed very goddamn relevant again. After being in danger of being dated. Like, I think I looked at that movie 2 or 3 years ago and thought, man, this isn't aging so well. And I think it was mostly like, it kind of seemed like a snapshot of 1989. I mean, it's the first thing you hear Public Enemy say on the soundtrack, 1989.
Right.
So it's like, I remember. But yeah, unfortunately that film is strangely relevant again. Malcolm X, this is where, when we're getting into like a biopic or a film of historical movement, this is more where your tastes lean. Would you say?
Yes. But I will say, I wasn't as familiar with Malcolm X as a person before going into this movie. I recognized
him. You were
him 9. That too.
So that too. Wait a minute. That's not fair. We're criticizing films because we're maturing.
But I saw it at that. I mean, I think, you know, I saw half of it that day, and then I saw like half of it probably weeks later. but I think if someone said today, like, oh, I'm going to do a Malcolm X movie, I'm like, no, we already heard that story. And that it's just, there's nothing else to say. Spike Lee covered a lot of ground in that movie. Right. And so, you know, there's nothing else to say about that. But, you know, I think that maybe if you want to talk about some of the people within his movement. And it's interesting, you know, when I think of Malcolm X, the character, in terms of Selma, because he is he has a very, very, very small role in Selma.
And it's a really fascinating role.
Yes, it is. It's truthfully, in real life, far more complicated and far bigger than that. His relationship was with Malcolm X. MLK. Yeah. So, but it was interesting that Ava Janae or Paul Webb or whoever decided to kind of really almost kind of, he was like, you know, passion ship in the night, like, yeah, I'm Malcolm X, this is what, you know, a little bit about me, and you'll never see me again. was he in like one or maybe two scenes?
One scene. Well, yeah. He shows up, and then he has that conversation with Coretta Scott King, and then he's gone.
Right.
That's it. Like, right. I don't even think he's on TV. But again, to me, I think that's a credit to the movie, because it could have turned into so much. Like, I really think that's two hands on the wheel there of saying, we are talking about this moment in time. Like, I'm sure, like, how many, I would love to know if anybody had such information, how many Martin Luther King scripts are knocking around Hollywood? There's gotta be dozens.
But that's kind of crazy to me.
That there's like, that
what
many
else
that,
are yeah? That what many else that are this you
the
saying?
First one? Sorry,
and he's not. Oh, sorry. Yes, that he. Yeah, that there's so many that we already kind of. He's one of the most popular people within that movement, within the civil rights era, and yet we're only for some reason we're only talking about his character when there's so many other people. I mean, if we're this fascinated with the civil rights era, we really need to blow it out.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the other people who are on the ground. Let's talk about the people who weren't necessarily within the movement per se, but had these other really interesting stories within the civil rights era. Like, let's talk about their stories. You know, I want to hear from people who lived that era, who we never have heard from before.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm at.
Do you feel like we get that in Malcolm X though?
No.
Okay. Well,
I don't. No, I don't. I'm contradicting myself a lot. But when it comes to, I think specifically when it comes to biopics, yes, of course I would love just, you know, to be focused on that one character, but when it comes to biopics that we already know, like Martin Luther King is a story that we already know, Four yeah. Little Girls is a story we already know, head nod to Spike Lee that he was also kind of represented in this film, in Selma as well, with the references to Four Little Girls, but you know, yeah, I think that there's, so if we're, you know, again, if we're fascinated with this era, let's really blow it out and talk about some of the people that we've never heard of before.
Just before we close this off, I'm going to throw you a rescue line. So, you know, No, Malcolm X doesn't do that, but no. Malcolm X is now 20 years ago. So you would think that in the time from there to now, we would have more of that, and we really don't. So Malcolm X not doing that 30 years after the civil rights movement is one thing. Selma not doing that 50 years after the civil rights movement is something very, very different, and not a lot in between. So that's, you know, if I'm going to kind of save you a little bit of face of your movie doesn't do it either. That's my theory.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, just to close out our talk about Selma and to wrap up the show, we do end with a souvenir. So, Candace, if there was any one thing that you could keep, be it a shot, a line, a tangible item from Selma as your souvenir, what would you keep?
You know, when I first saw the movie, the first thing that, I mean, one of the reactions I had to it, other than the fact that it was beautifully shot, was the costumes.
Oh, yeah.
I pretty much loved all of the costumes. I just love retro, like, 60s type, you know, clothes. And I thought of specifically Diane Nash, and this has to be like the last scene that she's in, and it's actually a group scene when them like kind of marching basically on Selma or in Selma, and she's wearing this dress, and I want that dress. Now I can't even think of the print, but I just remember thinking, I want this dress. So that's my souvenir.
We were so much better dressed back then, you know?
Oh my gosh, yes. We don't care about dress now, I feel like.
You know, this is the one thing it sounds terrible to say this, but I've got photographs that I took this summer when I was in St. Louis of the protests after Ferguson. And mm-hmm. The protests in Selma, like, they're dressed in shirts and ties. You know, they're it's a little bit different now when we're protesting. Mm-hmm. Although that was the one thing. Hey, did you notice? Did you see the photos of the protesters that walked out of the Capitol this week?
No, actually, I did not.
They walked on Friday. I want to say that it was. They walked out onto the steps and they did the hands up, don't shoot. And because they're all coming out of government jobs, they're all some really, really well dressed protesters.
Oh, see, we don't ever get that. Usually, it's like jeans and sneakers.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So
just came from the gym.
For me, my souvenir is actually one of those small moments, and it's to me, I think it's one of the moments that really defines the film. There's a scene where Coretta Scott King is. She's got to go meet Malcolm X, and she's speaking with I'm remiss to say I've totally forgotten which character she's talking to, but she's speaking with a woman, and she's talking about whether or not she's prepared to go and have this conversation.
I think that's Betty Shabazz.
Sorry?
I think that's Betty Shabazz.
Probably, yes. Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. And she says, I don't think I'm prepared. And the woman tells her, you're more prepared than you know. The blood that goes through you is the same blood that brought life into this world, that brought tools and organization and music and love into this world. And it's the blood that flows through you. So you are absolutely prepared. Now go do it. And it's just such a beautiful line. And it's a line that I wish, like, every little African-American boy and girl was taught, like, the mm-hmm. second they're old enough to comprehend that very thought, because it's just so damn beautiful. And I don't know if it's historical fact or if it came out of the mind of a screenwriter or what, but it might be one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard on film.
That's interesting. That's interesting because I'm just realizing that line right now, because I remember at the time I didn't really spend time with that line, but now that you mention it, it is a profound line. And
you,
I didn't
you
think
didn't like
this...
watch this on your phone or something, did you?
No, I watched this on the big screen. But it was interesting because, you know, I was just thinking that the film didn't have a whole lot of really standout lines other than the one that I think is great, spoken by David Oyelowo about him being a man.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. Like, you know, I'm not anything special. Yeah. I mean, that's not what he said about not being special, but that's what I got from it. And that's what I was begging for the entire movie. Like, I like that sense of vulnerability, but I like the fact that not only is he represented as a human, but also that he understands himself as a human. Because I really think, and I continue to think, that a lot of these movements get way bigger than the actual person behind it.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Way bigger.
Yeah.
And I think that was finally when we realized, when the writer realizes or when the character realizes it, definitely when the audience realizes, like, oh, this is much bigger. Like, this is somebody who could have done, you know, I could have done the same thing that he did, but he's doing it, you know? And that's kind of what that... one of the things that scene is representing to me.
Totally. Well, we close out our reviews here on the Matinee Cast by rating the film on a scale of 1 to 4 stars. Candace Frederick, singular, what is your score for Selma on a scale of 1 to 4?
I'll say 2.5.
Seriously? You're giving this a C?
That's like a D plus. No. I was thinking more like a B minus.
So okay, three.
Three.
All right, a negative three. Wow, it's funny. I'm giving this movie a 4. This is one of my favorite movies of the year, and it just kicked my ass. And I the one thing I will say just before we move on is when you do go back to it, because I know you will eventually.
Yes.
Look at it just on a technical level. I think that might have been what drew me in. Is there's a lot of really, really cool photography in this movie, and a lot of cool things done with sound. And pay attention to how many times somebody's talking, but we're looking at like the side of their head or the back of their head, or sometimes we're looking at them from like down around their knees. There's some really cool shots this movie that really makes you thrown off kilter and really kind of have to focus that little bit more. So like that was one of those things. But no, this is a top film for me, and I'm sure I'll be talking about it again in 2 weeks when I do the year end show. But we'd love to know what you folks think of Selma when you do see it. Hopefully you get to see it soon. Let me know. Maybe Candace is off her nut. Maybe I'm off my nut. Who knows? Somewhere in between, the truth lies. But that is episode 126 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Wednesday, December 31st for episode 127. We'll be closing out the year and discuss our top five of 2014 at the movies. Candace, my God, she's all over the place. She is at realtalkonline.org. She's at blackgirlnerds.com and the Cinema and Noir podcast, which you can find at Blog Talk Radio. Do you guys have anything coming up this week that you want to plug?
Well, we are back on the air, Blog Talk Radio, tomorrow at 6 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, you can catch all my writing at, or most of my writing, at Real Talk Online.
Very cool. And if people want to follow you on Twitter, where can they find you?
Real Talker, R-E-E-L-T-A-L-K-E-R.
Score. My site is thematinee.ca. For more audio content, you can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them on Stitcher Radio, apps like Podkicker, Blueberry, and Apple's podcasting app, and of course the iTunes Store. Everything gives you handy ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on Selma, I Will Follow, Malcolm X, and anything else you want to tell me before I close out the show for the year can be left in the comment section of the site. You can email Ryan at thematinee.ca, Twitter, Ryan Matinee underscore CA, or facebook.com/darkmatinee. So I'm officially letting you go 9 minutes late, but any final thoughts before I finally let you go?
Well, you were talking about photography, and I wanted to reiterate again that Bradford Young is the cinematographer for Selma, and he is always, almost pretty much exclusively fantastic. So if you liked the photography and his work here, definitely catch Mother of George, which I should have probably mentioned earlier, but it doesn't really relate to Selma. But if you love the shots in Selma, definitely watch Mother of George, or even Restless City, or even Ain't Them Bobby Saints, which I didn't love, but watch it for the cinematography. So yes, I just wanted to say that.
Well, that's cool. I'll consider that recommendation a Christmas gift. That's good.
Yes, there you go.
Well, for Candace, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.